Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
In this week's edition of the Catskill Review of Books, we're speaking to FT columnist, that's Financial Times, to the uninitiated, John Authors, whose new book, The Fearful Rise of Markets, Global Bubbles, Synchronized Meltdowns, and How to Prevent Them in the Future, is an eye-opener in many ways. I'm not quite sure it sort of really shows how to prevent them in the future. I get the impression there's a lot of dandruff falling on people's desks as they think about this. But the key part of your book, John, I think, is that people are desperately searching for sort of hedges and security in the markets while trying to get gain. And the net effect of all of these sort of well-intentioned market-led sort of moves has been to synchronize the world markets in an unprecedented way. So everything, sort of the Australian dollar and the S&P and gold and the Shanghai Stock Exchange, are all sort of inextricably connected in some sort of quantum fashion.
That's about right. Yes, I mean there's both academic theory and there's common sense behind this. It's not often that both of those things go together, but the idea was to be safer, to reduce risks, to diversify. You needed not to put all your eggs into one basket. You needed to look for other areas in which to invest. So that's plainly accords with common sense, but there's also very precise mathematical formulae behind it, which suggest that if you have already have a big fund full of relatively risky stocks, you can actually make it safer by adding relatively risky, say, Chinese stocks or commodities, even if they're very volatile, providing that they're not correlated with the stuff you already have, because then there's a decent chance that when the stocks you already have are down, the commodities or the Chinese stocks or whatever will be doing well. So there became this big attempt to look for uncorrelated assets, because this was a way to reduce your risk without reducing your return, which is what everybody wanted to do. The problem was there were any number of different asset classes which over time hadn't been correlated with the main indices where investors were investing. But that was because nobody had particularly regarded them as being the same kind of a thing. They had different investors in them for investing in them for different reasons. Once you had big fund managers working from one very clearly defined model, which argued that when stocks looked overpriced, you should put more money into, say, commodities. What you tended then to have was the beginning of a correlation between those asset classes, and everything got to the point where there's a research by a guy called Rob Arnott, who runs a fund management company and used to be an academic out in California, which I quote in the book, and he traces 16 different asset classes, completely or allegedly completely different asset classes. And in October 2008, the month after Lehman, the month when the bottom really fell out, all 16 of them were down, which is really quite difficult to do. But somehow or other, people sold lots of assets without particularly buying any others. It was just a question of an evaporation of value or apparent value once people realized that all these different markets had in effect supported each other upwards. They weren't non-correlated, they weren't independent from each other. Everything
a bubble, in fact, is what you were saying.
Yes, yes. One very, very large one. Do another name drop. George Soros, even before it burst, was on record calling it a super bubble. But each part of each different market helped help support the others, even though it required the support from the others to be where it was. It was a complete triumph of wishful thinking.
Yeah, George Soros, I think, had the right idea. He gave the fancy term reflexivity to it. So basically, that that people running around, that the analogy I always have is the lemming. As you remember, the the Scandinavian rodent that occasionally runs off the edge of cliffs and everyone goes together. And it's always struck me as the perfect metaphor for most investment professionals. They will all run off the cliff together. So,
I think that's true. The analogy with the lemming is a very good one. My own personal favourite is with the wildebeest. At one point, we even considered calling the whole book bulls, bears, and wildebeest. If you think about the way wildebeest behave, going around in those vast herds in on the Serengeti, at one level, this is that tells you about human nature. We all of us dislike going against the herd, dislike sticking out against the crowd. We're all of us prone to groupthink. But at another level, in the markets, the people who are actually driving market prices are being paid, are being given an incentive to behave like so many wildebeest. They're not being, you know, a big fund manager who's in charge of our retirement assets isn't being paid to try to go out there and beat the market. He's being paid to accumulate assets, to build up as much money as possible.
But they get paid on assets managed, not on how well those assets do. So, as long
broadly
as they...
speaking, yes, there are some, you know, there are some minor exceptions to that. But basically, you're being paid. If a lot of money walks out of the door, you get paid less. If a lot of money comes in the door, you get paid more. And if what you in fact did was nothing more than follow the S&P or the Dow Jones upwards. And really added no value, that won't matter. It will still increase the size of the fund and it'll still therefore increase the percentage you can take from it. So there is a strong incentive on fund managers. What they don't want is for their money to go out the door, and the way that happens is if they take some kind of a risk, stick out from the herd and do worse. So the incentive instead is to look at what other people are doing and do that, because then if things go up, that's great, and if things go down, at least you haven't embarrassed yourself because everybody else has done the same thing. You probably won't see your money being taken away.
I think we should come in here for some self-criticism for the journalist fraternity, because it struck me that this behaviour is indistinguishable from most journalists, full stop, covering beats. But the financial journalists have spent, with a few honourable exceptions, many of which were on the Financial Times, I'm pleased to say, have basically been involved in boosterism and, you know, Panglossian optimism. This is the best of all possible markets and will always remain so.
Yes, there's certainly something to that. I think there was more to be said for that coming up into the very first phase of the crisis, which is the internet bubble back in the 1999-2000. At that point, certainly there was a lot of very uncritical coverage in the media, and it was very difficult to avoid that sense of excitement. I think coming into this latest and in the end much more severe crisis that came to a head in 2008, that was somewhat different. It wasn't so much that the press got carried away and boosted. It was that the press didn't really look closely enough at the various products, particularly in the credit market, which were not so immediately apparent, were not so easily understood, and not enough was done to raise the alarm. Yes,
I think when it comes to
horrible exceptions, but yeah, sorry, yeah.
When it comes to the Fourth Estate, I think the sins of omission are every bit as serious as sins of commission.
Yes, exactly. I would say this one was more about the sins of omission, whereas back in the late 90s, there were very real sins of commission. I mean, that, you know, looking through personal finance magazines, the covers of them were almost pornographic in terms of the kind of lascivious excitement that were generating about the money you could make in the stock markets, and that was unfortunate.
All I think specific liquidity, yummy.
Yes, exactly. But you know, in general, and this is a criticism you can make of the press in politics as well, as the tendency to look at things as a horse race. To look at how funds have done over the last month or the last 3 months or whatever, and to express things as in league tables, and that's very dangerous, because most people need to make their money over a very long period of time, Stressing short-term performance is often a way to cause bubbles to inflate, to cause trends to get over-exaggerated as people follow them to extinction. It's not a way to encourage good investment practices, and it's not a good way to educate the public. So certainly, judged collectively, the Fourth Estate has almost as many questions to answer as anybody else in terms of the disaster that happens. I'd like to think the Financial Times has a slightly better record than most.
But, well, I think so from the outside point of view. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and today we're speaking to John Authors. His book, The Fearful Rise of Markets, Global Bubbles, Synchronized Meltdowns, and How to Prevent Them in the Future, is just out from FT, that's Financial Times Press. I mean, there are sort of basic beliefs in question here, which you don't for I think fairly obvious reasons go into, but since the days of Ronald Reagan, the Western world has been obsessed with the idea that the markets hold the answer to every solution. So market's good, government's bad. And here we have markets managing a massive pile-up and governments coming in to rescue them. And yet the country club wisdom I hear on the especially in the Senate and much of Congress seems unchanged by this experience.
Yes, it's well... maybe the forums you just mentioned, yes, I suppose that's true, that there really hasn't been any big change to the wisdom. I tend to think of markets as being a little bit like what Winston Churchill said about democracy, which I think was that it's the worst way of running a country apart from all the others. You know, I think markets are probably the worst way to allocate resources apart from all the others. It's a mechanism that a sensible government refuses to use only at its peril. That being said, what I would say has changed to some extent is the sense that a market outcome is endowed with some kind of moral correctness. There is a better understanding, I think, after the crisis, that markets can go very badly wrong, can start to generate very inefficient prices. And when you have capital, commodities, credit, the various building blocks of the economy being systematically mispriced, then capitalism isn't going to work as well as it should. Which I'm certainly very comfortable arguing. That in turn tends to suggest, as we all discovered in 08 and 09 when everything went pear-shaped, that inhibitions about government intervention have to be shelved. Where the balance will lie in future, I still don't know. Plainly, the pendulum had come far too far towards a belief that that markets could be trusted completely. You would expect the pendulum to go too far in the other direction. It's quite intriguing that, yes, you're right, the pendulum has barely got back to the middle of the dial, which does surprise me. I don't think I completely agree with your initial comment. I do think there is more of an acknowledgement or an acceptance that markets can get it wrong, and that sometimes it's necessary for democratically elected governments.
You didn't hear anyone in the Republican. Right. You didn't hear anyone in the Republican Party say that, though, did you?
No, I don't. I don't believe I did.
Just checking, because in case I'd missed something. The other part that you bring out well in the book is the sort of the concentration of decision making. When Adam Smith wrote about the invisible hand of the market, he was thinking of hundreds of thousands of millions of individual transactions, which, like a sort of Brownian movement of molecules, approximate out to a proper value, a proper price, value for labor, value for goods, value for commodities. And, the point you bring in here is not just the convergence of all of these different funds, so it's just one pool of liquidity slushing around the globe, being paddled along by the lemmings or the wildebeest. It's the concentration of decision-making. You have huge funds and money managers making decisions, And as you say, they're converging around indexes. Even people are taking large fees as money managers, basically to emulate the indices. And at the same time, you've got all of these computer models and various forms of computer trading going on in all sorts of derivatives, pushing and pulling. And as you demonstrate quite well, a lot of these mathematical formulae are it's like the one that takes a takes a rat and models it as a sphere, because that's the easiest way to do it mathematically. They are somewhat out of sync with reality.
Yes, I mean, what's very distressing is that back in the early 60s, you had I interviewed him for the book. This very, very remarkable man called Benoit Mandelbrot, who's a in many ways a genius mathematician.
He was the one who was big on chaos theory, and he seems to be the man whose time has come from the name of
Yes, exactly. Now that he's in his late 80s, people have worked out that he was right all along. And he was able to establish in the early 60s that the assumptions of Brownian motion just didn't apply to commodity markets, they were more volatile than that. You got more extreme events in both directions than you would get if with pure Brownian motion. And the reason people are quite right. The reason people chose not to follow that. I mean, some of the great founders of modern portfolio theory were people who had been taught by him. One suspects is that if you go along with Mandelbrot, then you need to do fantastically complicated mathematics of the kind that is used to measure fluid chaos and thermodynamics or whatever. It's remarkably complicated mathematics to have a hope of being able to predict or understand markets. Whereas if you made the safer assumptions of Brownian motion and randomness, then you could start actually putting a precise number on risk, and then a precise number on how you could trade off risk and return best. And if you can actually put a number on risk, then you feel very good about it. You feel as though you've controlled it, and you start getting overconfident. And if you're an academic, you can start really making some very interesting conclusions.
They rest
on completely unrealistic assumptions, but they still seem to be fantastic conclusions.
Well, to go back to where we were a moment ago, I mean, the point about the Brownian movement of molecules is that molecules collectively, a gas will expand with heat. But if you look at an individual molecule, the technical term to describe its movement is the drunkard's walk. And what we had here was the sort of, instead of a large universe of investors and traders, what we had was a few drunken molecules careering around the financial universe, it would appear.
Yes, exactly. But what you didn't have was the pure randomness. I mean, the phrase used in finance is the random walk. It wasn't a simple random walk with shifting direction when there was a new bit of news. There was a much clearer trend until things had become totally unsupportable, which was followed by an even clearer trend straight off the side of the cliff, rather than a random or drunkard walk.
Once again, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and we're talking to John Authors, whose book, The Fearful Rise of Markets, promises to look at global bubbles, synchronized meltdowns, and how to prevent them in the future. When we're looking at the market correlations here, it's amazing how it's the sort of contagion spread, and how the usual formulae, as you were pointing out, didn't apply. That, you know, when stocks go one way, bonds go another. When commodities go one way, they go another. And the emerging markets was really interesting, because I've looked at the BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and I actually spoke to the Goldman Sachs economist who invented it. They seem to have worked. They seem to be recovering. They seem to have broken the correlation. But is this because of the inherent worth of their economies and the fact they're producing things that people want, even in the height of recession? Or because savvy investors have decided that they should be pumping money into them?
Something of both. mean, I think one of the critical moments in the rebound from the crash in the darkest days of 2008 was when the Chinese government announced it was going to do its own stimulus package, and very quickly showed that it seriously meant business. You know, let banks start lending at a quite furious rate, and spent a lot of money on infrastructure projects. And given the nature of the way that country is run, it was able to inject that adrenaline right into the heart of the economy much more quickly than has been possible anywhere in Europe or the US. And that was certainly a sort of real, you know, quote-unquote, good reason for markets to start to recover. That being said, you have the very great concern over China that what it was doing there looked unsustainable, and you plainly have the risk that it's going to form further bubbles. At the moment, it looks very tentatively as though they might be doing the nearly impossible and letting the air slowly out of a bubble. It's usually very difficult to do without it bursting. But there's still room to question that. Beyond that, what does concern me, though, is that the way the emerging markets recovered really does look quite a lot like people were just using the script that had worked for several years before the implosion of 2008. They're buying it, they're buying commodities at the same time they were buying emerging market currencies at the same time. We had the same sort of big correlated reflation trade. And that worries me because in the short term, it doesn't. You know, we don't look to me as though the world economy is reflating and showing signs of inflation or anything like that. It looks quite the opposite. So there's a risk of outright deflation. You know, we look more like the US in the early 30s or Japan in the 90s than we look like Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe or whatever you care to mention. There are some basic decent reasons. The Chinese stimulated their economy much more aggressively than people thought they were going to do, and much more initially successfully than people thought they were going to do. And so far, without the negative fallout that it was rational to fear. So there are. I'm not going to say that the boom in emerging markets is completely ridiculous, but I'm still quite alarmed by it. It's still there. Still, ultimately, makes little sense to me that in an environment that is where the deflationary risks are very great, people are behaving as though in a way that they would behave when they wanted to protect themselves from inflation.
These markets seem to be almost operating in a separate universe from the actual world of what classical economics, where people bought things and sold them. You know, actual physical goods, and you know one of the you don't mention in your book, for example, the one of the early canaries that fell off the perch was the auction rate securities, $340 billion, where companies like JetBlue suddenly found that the money they were counting on to pay for the payroll was frozen up because the market had just dried up completely.
Yes, so that was old auction rate securities. I remember them. Yes. that was one of the scary things. I managed to get as much in as I could. The sheer panoply of things that went wrong before they were done. The ultimate link to the real world that a lot of these securities had. It ultimately comes back to that Soros notion of reflexivity, that markets don't just reflect reality, sometimes they create it. You know, if people buy oil because they think inflation is going to go up, then the price of oil goes up, and oil is in the inflation index, so inflation does indeed go up. There are ways in which markets can, for quite a long time, actually create their own reality. And things like the auction rate securities bust is another very good example of how that can carry on for a remarkably long time, but not, unfortunately, forever. Not unfortunately until if it had carried on until a nice 10 or 20 years after I'd retired, it would have been fine. But unfortunately, in my case at any rate, the game was up when I'm still expecting to have to work for a living for quite a lot longer.
Well, now, Dr. Watson, the game is still afoot. You have sort of 30 seconds to tell us how to turn it all around and how to stop the world going pear-shaped.
Okay, how to turn it around and how to stop the world going pear-shaped. We need, fundamentally, we need to get the people who play in the markets to behave as though the money they are dealing with is their own, not somebody else's. This is the fundamental change of the last 50 years, is that you've had a split between principals who actually own shares or bonds and the agents who trade in them, who hold them in funds and so on. That, to do that, we need to change the way in which we pay fund managers and investors. We probably need to see a change in investment banking, where we move to something that looks more like the old model, where investment banks were like partnerships. We're run as partnerships. That may in some ways make them more like what we currently call hedge funds. And we need to try to deal with the groupthink that afflicts everybody in the investment community by abandoning the theories that everybody is taught as part of their MBA or their CFA that markets are efficient, and need to come up with a much subtler theory of how markets work, which unfortunately will be much more complicated and will require us, this is most critical, to be much humbler. People thought they could actually measure risk and return with precision, and the whole point is that you can't, and that you have, therefore, to be more conservative than you would like and admit that you're not going to make all the money, all the profit that you would like. That is the normal interplay of greed with fear, and we need to get back to that. We need to have humbler investors and a humbler attitude towards our understanding of how markets work. And I think most listeners will gather things aren't looking where we are now, things aren't looking good for that extra humility to take hold.
Humbleness does not seem to characterize the masters of the universe as they dip the till for even bigger bonuses.
Not at this moment, no.
So, thank you. This is Ian Williams, and I've been speaking to John Authors, whose book, The Fearful Rise of Markets, is just out. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Tune in next week at the same time for another edition of the Catskill Review of Books on WJFF.